I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My guest today is Fenech Soler, who is the author of many articles as well as a number of novels. And the first thing that I am dying to ask him is that your real name?
Well, hi, Greg. It's great to be with you and the Countercurrents Radio team. No, it's not. It's, of course, a pseudonym or a made-up name. And the reality is that that's because, essentially, I've worked within an industry professionally for many years, which is extremely antagonistic to the type of values that we share. So I've had to go undercover as a ghost skin for many years in order to earn a living, but also, as you know yourself, to make donations to websites and other organizations that I feel, you know, deserve support.
Right. And what does the pseudonym mean?
Okay. Well, it's actually a misreading of a brand name off the back of a beer mat that I once saw in the south of France. It's a complete hodgepodge, if you like. It just sounded good to me when I played around with it a few weeks later and decided essentially it sounded a bit better than the plain Joe name that I was given and born with. And it would draw a bit of attention, essentially, to my writing. The other influence, and if people are aware of some of the articles I've written on Countercurrents, they'll recall I did quite a large three-piece article on Hidden Faces by Salvador Dali, his only novel. And there were great sort of names in there, like the Marquis de Granciers and Solange de Cleda. And I read that when I was about 14 or 15, and it sort of gave me this sort of incredible buzz, you know, this thought that I could be as grandiose as that. So it's totally pretentious, and I openly admit that. So please bear with me.
Okay, well, that's great. So you've written four novels now. One is The Partisan, that came out in 2014, and then Rising, which Countercurrents actually published in 2017. Yeah. Then there's Crawl, which came out in 2019, and then Resistance, which came out from Skylore Books this year. And you've done hundreds of articles and short stories and poems. You've been at Countercurrents and European Civil War and New European Conservative and on and on. So can you tell us how you became a thought criminal? I guess that's the next question. Yeah. How did you end up in this kind of company?
Okay. Well, I never had a sort of Bernie Goetz moment, if you understand what I mean. I never came to there was never an incident or a catalyst that generated my views. As I've said in previous articles and interviews with people, this was totally instinctual for me, okay? I was brought up in a predominantly white working class community. Obviously, I'm British. People can tell that by my accent. In fact, Welsh British as well. So there was no immediate problem with vibrancy or multiculturalism when I was growing up. So it was completely instinctive. And I sort of began educating myself or familiarizing myself with the sort of right-wing milieu as I grew up through my later teenage years into my early 20s. So in the British traditions, not so much the Mosleyite traditions, you know, the uniformed look, although I'm, you know, a great admirer of much of Mosley's opinions and whatever. It was more the end years of the National Front. So I was sort of conscious of the politics and the gestation of that organization, which started in about 67, right the way through to the early 80s. So that's really where I come from politically and ideologically. I've subsequently obviously moved on from those initial beginnings and familiarized myself with people like de Benoist and Guylaine Fay. But of course, when I was very young, that was essentially in small translated works or very hybrid sort of pieces, because only in recent years have their works been published, you know, properly in English. And my French is very poor. You know, I did study French in school, but it's not good enough to read sophisticated theory or philosophy. Certainly the stuff that de Benoist would be writing. So I became self-educated and relished, you know, just learning more and more, and started reading Yockey and Carl Schmitt and you know, thinkers along that trajectory.
Very, very interesting. Were you at all in the sort of music scenes that sort of are quasi-rightist when you were younger? Was that an influence at all? Or was it more something like the political scene of the National Front?
Yeah, it was more the political scene. The music scene that was on the right wing of that milieu was the Oi music of that time. And that mostly didn't appeal to me. You know, Ian Stewart Donaldson, I think, was a really good writer. And some of the saga reinterpretations of his work are quite musical and quite interesting. But I was never quite that way. I was a little bit more, people will sort of smile, I was a bit more Led Zeppelin and Yes and those sort of bands, you know, the more sort of progressive rock type of sound, which wasn't necessarily right-wing in any way, but it was very white culture. And very embedded in our mythology, very embedded in our sort of folklore. So that really set off a whole sort of adventure for me. It linked into books I'd read earlier, like The Lord of the Rings, obviously, and C.S. Lewis. And after that, you know, matured into things, books like Dune, Frank Herbert, which I know you're a great admirer of. And, you know, I really loved the Dune trilogy, the initial trilogy. And that sort of, again, was a complete fictional world that I completely absorbed and embedded myself in for many years.
That's very interesting. I do agree that prog rock, British prog rock, is a very identitarian kind of phenomenon. They might not know it necessarily, but you can't tell me that Led Zeppelin IV is Delta blues. There's a bit of that thrown in there, but it's more, it's very much English folk music. And English music traditions, I think that's primarily what I hear there.
Yeah.
With the, you know, the importation of certain things from the U.S., definitely.
Yeah, that's true. And then moving on from that sort of influence musically, I'm talking now. Of course, there was the big bands like Joy Division, for example, which I've written articles on your site and on Patriotic Alternative. Articles for them. They were a massive influence, and that was a very British sound coming out of the post-New Wave, post-punk period, which really inspired me. Curtis was a great writer. I think you commented once that, you know, it is music to commit suicide to, and I have a sort of sympathy for that. There's a very dark Mancunian north of England sound to it, but it was majestic and beautiful. And from them, I got into bands like Death in June, which I think you also like.
Absolutely.
And I really liked Early Death in June particularly. I thought some of their music was simply breathtaking. And I still got the vinyl pressings, you know, the original vinyl pressings, because I was so impressed with them as a band.
Well, that's really very interesting. There was a really rich musical culture that was quasi-rightist. And I think that still continues. Death in June is still around. Current 93 is still around. But I think a lot of the creative energy has sort of migrated out of music even into, I don't know, making memes and things like that, which I don't think is quite the same medium. Let's talk about the medium that you chose besides, of course, the essay and the review. But you also chose the medium of the novel. Why did you decide to write novels?
Because I was very dissatisfied with the movement fiction that had been produced up to that point. It was a little bit one-dimensional, a bit predictable. Some of it was exciting, but it was always about revenge motivation, etc., and things of that nature. And I just thought the movement deserved more, just deserved far more imaginative and creative processes, because we were lacking in that direction. So I essentially took it upon myself. I mean, there are many other great writers, and I'll comment on them later, but I took it upon myself to make an effort to do that. So I began writing The Partisan some years before it was published. Because obviously I was a newcomer. I was a debut novelist. I hadn't attempted something as long as that before. Short stories and poems are nowhere near like the skill set and that the construction of the art form is very different. So I had to teach myself really how to do that and discipline myself as well to produce a sentient story that was, you know, was credible. So it took some time. And one of the reasons why I did it was not just because I think the movement needs that, but also because I wanted to embed sort of the richness and the culture of the philosophy, the ideology, right across the broad swathe of, I'll use the word European, but obviously I include American, Australian thinkers in all this. I'm talking European in the broadest sense, regardless of geography. I think there's such a rich panoply of thinking and ideological value that I've attempted to, and do sometimes overplay it, embed that within the texts, because I want people who are coming to this movement, if you like, if they pick up one of my novels, to be excited, to be hopefully to feel that it's a little bit artistic. It may not be perfect, but it's an attempt at artistry, and to find trails, if you like, into other thinkers and other writers, indeed, who will get them more and more interested. So it's if you like a teaser to bring people in to be entertained and then to understand the depth behind our movement's general concepts, be it political, economic, cultural, you know, whatever.
So who are some of the other fiction writers that you were thinking of?
Well, one that I was very impressed with, he's no longer on the scene, and he was actually responsible for publishing Partisan, was Alex Kurtigich. He was running Wormore and Wormore Press at that time. And not only did he publish his own fiction, Mister, but he also was publishing lots of Bowden's work. And I still got those, the original immaculate pressings from Wormore and Wormore of Bowden's work. Because, of course, Bowden wasn't just an orator and indeed a philosopher. He was a writer. And his writing is a little bit more difficult to get into, but it is definitely worth investigating. And for those who haven't attempted that yet, I really would suggest that they do. I know you've published works about Bowden, but the actual text of his own observations, short novellas, etc., are really very, very interesting. And Bowden, in a sense, again, was someone who lifted me, my spirits. When I listened to Bowden speaking, I can totally identify not only with the way he puts his message over, but also the content. Again, Bowden can speak for 2 hours without notes and give detailed information about writers, philosophers, etc., and drop in anecdotes. He's an incredible character who we sorely miss.
I absolutely agree. I got to know him, I think, fairly well near the end of his life. I spent some time with him in California. He actually came to a Countercurrents event in February of 2012. And a month later, he was dead. Very sad. And I felt like I was really getting to know him because we spent a lot of time together. And it was an interesting crew of people. We had Charles Kraft there, for instance, at that event. Yeah. And many of our other friends and writers. I can mention Charlie now because he died last year. And he was very open about his participation in Countercurrents events. And we're actually going to bring out a collection of some of his interviews that he gave and some of the talks that he gave at various events. Are there other authors that you're thinking of? Did you read, for instance, somebody like Harold Covington's novels?
No, I've got them, but I've never actually delved into them. I think Alex actually persuaded me not to write in the style of Harold Covington. So I've actually got them on a shelf, tucked away in my library, but I've actually never opened them, I'm sad to say. And what would you recommend that I do? Is that someone you think is worthy of reading and getting into?
Well, yeah, I wrote a review of the four novels, the first four novels of his Northwest series. He wrote a fifth, where I praise them fairly highly. It's on Countercurrents if you want to take a look at it. He was a problematic character, but I have to give him credit for being a talented storyteller. So let's talk a bit about your most recent novel, Resistance. What, in a nutshell, is Resistance about?
Okay. Well, it's the story, a universal story, about a young man growing up. I placed the young man in Belgium and going to college in the Netherlands, but he could have been in Wisconsin. He could have been in California. He could have been in South London. The reality, it's a young white man growing up, being subjected to progressive views by the sort of late 60s, early 70s generation, you know, the post-68ers, being subjected to the incredible media storm of political correctness, which has now mutated further into wokeness, however you define that. I mean, I find it hard to define, but I know it when I see it, as we all do. And watching and observing as he's maturing, the circumstances in his school, because I take him right from quite a young age, through his school years, through to college, how his town transforms, how his community is changed, indeed obliterated within a few years, and how it impacts his family. I don't want to give too much away, other than to say that it is an extremely adventurous read, certainly in its second half. This man goes through a transformation. This man goes from what I would describe as a fairly woke, standard, you know, 17, 18-year-old into an ardent political soldier by the end of his experiences. And the experiences, and this is quite important, I think, Greg, to get over to the readers who are not familiar with my works. What I do is I actually take real events in history, those that have, you know, occurred in recent years, and I project how I think that those will, you know, transfer into future events. So it's futuristic, but not that far in the future. And I take those real events and add obviously a fictional element in order to get over the message, essentially, that this transformation is for everybody. Everyone is going to come across this, increasingly so as multiculturalism breaks down, or rather society is broken down by things like multiculturalism and the erosion, basically, of identity. Not just identity as an individual, but identity as a community. And, there's so many different levels of experience this man goes through, or young man goes through, which takes him, you know, into the second half of the novel. There's some, you know, tragic circumstances around his immediate family, but they're all credible and believable because picking up a newspaper, reading, you know, the internet news, listening to the radio, these things are all going on around us today. This isn't some, you know, incredible futuristic vision. These things are happening to real people today. And I just wanted in the fiction for people to read and identify with that and take it very, very seriously. It's a warning. It's not a paranoid conspiracy novel. It's a very realistic and based novel on lived experience. Not necessarily my own, because I never lived in Belgium and I didn't grow up as a Belgian, but that's another element to it. I'm a pan-Europeanist, so the book covers many different circumstances around the globe, ultimately, because I do believe in pan-European unity. I ultimately believe that's the only way we're going to overcome some of the problems that we have. And I don't know how you feel about that. You've read the book, so do you think some of the things I've said you can recognize?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think what you're saying is good, because you don't want to give too much away, but you want to get people interested in reading it. So how do you envision your audience? If you want people out there listening to be your readers, tell us a bit about how you envision those readers. What are your ideal readers?
Okay, well, I think my ideal readers are very varied. I think there are newcomers to the movement who are just on the fringe. They've maybe heard something on the internet, heard someone speak, maybe come across some interesting books or analysis, maybe visited websites like Countercurrents, obviously, and Patriotic Alternative in the UK. And suddenly got a taste for wanting to find out more. So by looking at this fiction, hopefully they will be drawn in a positive way to thinking more broadly and being entertained about the movement. So it's the newcomers. There's then a whole level above that, which is people already active in the movement, who are both active and are ideologically committed and have been for some time. And I'm hoping that they will recognize through the fiction a drawing together of some conclusions they've already arrived at. They'll recognize some of the influences and the books they've read in what I've written. They'll see the influences upon me of certain thinkers and writers. And thirdly, obviously the real, if you like, ideologically committed, the thinkers of our own movement, and there are many of those, you're amongst that group, who hopefully will smile benevolently and think to themselves, yeah, that's a worthwhile project. That's going to help me and my website and my thinking and the meetings I organize to get the message out more generally. So that's, I'm ambitious, but hopefully that's a sort of response that people like yourself would have to the novel. You might not necessarily be a fan of fiction, but hopefully you will see that's a contribution, an ultimate contribution to the projects that you want to bring to fruition.
Right. So can you tell us about some of your literary models or inspirations?
Sure. Well, they're extremely varied. I mentioned there's always fundamental building blocks, and the ones for me from childhood would be, as I've mentioned before, people like Tolkien and Lewis and that group of writers. Dune, I've already mentioned, so Frank Herbert. So on the fictional side, if you like, there's those writers. But rather than the likes of, you know, Dr. William Pierce, whose books I've read and some elements of them I really enjoy, my influences are a bit more, again, pretentious. They're a bit more Louis Ferdinand Céline, you know, people of that nature, Albert Camus, writers not necessarily of our ilk, but artists and thinkers who have advanced the literary form in some way, shape or form. In terms of poetry, obviously, Eliot. I've just written an article on T.S. Eliot and the Jewish question on PA, which I really enjoyed writing. George Orwell is always a standard, and I've written an article on PA for him about him as well the other day. So, you know, many writers of that type. And in terms of poetry, you know, absolutely, Ezra Pound, you know, a classic writer and thinker, and someone who I was reading, Jefferson and or Mussolini, I think I read when I was about 16. I'm not sure I understood it properly, but it definitely inspired me to study my first degree, which had an American studies bent to it. So if anything, Pound, despite being, you know, living in Italy and being very anglicized, was still an American. And he drew me into American writing. And I would read Kerouac, William Burroughs, you know, all these people, these great writers. Again, not necessarily people that ideologically are on our side of the fence, but nevertheless, great writers in their own right who I've read, studied to an extent, and admired. And they've all left a trace and influence on me. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I'll let other people decide, but they've all left a trace on me.
So you've written now four novels. I understand that you have others in the works or planned.
Sure.
And there are some overlaps between these novels that I've noticed. So can you explain the connections between them? Sure. Are these part of a larger project?
Very much so, Greg. I've got a projected 7 or 8 novel. Ideally, it'll be 7. Let's see if I can contain it within that framework. The characters in certainly in Rising, the book that Countercurrents first published for me, the character Jansen in that is the young man essentially in Resistance. We see him at a more mature point in his career. And he makes quite a big impact in Rising about 2/3 of the way through. So he's a character that I knew about when I wrote about him. I knew I'd revisit him. So this is the backstory for him, for example. So this, which is quite a large novel, it's about 323 pages, I think, Skylore Books have published. So I've dedicated quite a large amount of time and storyline to him, because I think he's an interesting character who people will identify with. The other key character emerged in my first novel, which is The Partisan, and that's Sabine Dorlach, who's the French resistance fighter. And actually, on Countercurrents, I think it was James O'Meara wrote a brilliant review, and a very fair review, I have to say. There were some criticisms, because I deserved it. It was a debut novel. But he wrote a really great review of that novel on Countercurrents. And Sabine is also a link person. She is referenced in all the other novels in some way, shape or form. She forms the spine, if you like, of resistance, which I've focused around France quite deliberately. And the reason for that is because, people might disagree, but I think France is on the fastest trajectory to meltdown at the moment. We've seen that, I think, in recent years and months under Macron particularly. And of course, I wrote that particular novel 5 or 6 years ago now. So, it's almost becoming accurate and becoming, not fiction anymore, but almost an historical reality. So placing a character like her, and again, I deliberately chose a female because I don't know about you, Greg, but I'm really, bored stiff of the misogynistic morons that sometimes inhabit our spheres. We have really got to get past that, okay? There are many women with intellectual capability and knowledge and activism who we need to are fully on board and respect. So I'm quite keen to do that. And so I put this very active female as the main character there.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I am very tired of people in a tiny movement that is constantly trying to grow, spending their time snarling and grousing and discouraging half the human race from contributing to what they themselves think is the most important cause in the world.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, I don't want to get hung up on those issues, but in interviews I've done with John Morgan, for example, on your website, and indeed at European Civil War, I've always pushed the point that we really do need to be, we're a small unit, but we need to get as many people inside that big tent. Now there's a juxtaposition of a point, but you understand what I mean, as we can.
Right.
Just a typical example. Let's just take a typical example who you're very familiar with. Look at the work Laura Towler does.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. That's an example. Now I speak to Laura, every other day. We're in communication. Okay. I've grown to respect her thinking, admire her energy, and quite frankly, I'm quite jealous of her bravery. This is someone who's out there in the public domain taking it on the chin for us every day, along with her husband. Incredible, incredible people. Keyboard warriors like myself need to get right behind those people. We really do. And I'll say that quite openly. Laura is a damn good example in Britain, within the British context, a damn good example of what I'm describing.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I think she's a national treasure. And I've very much enjoyed meeting her for the first time. I guess it was in 2019 now. Everything has been so frozen because of COVID it was 2019 when we met. I can't believe so much time has passed. But a lot has been accomplished, even though we haven't been doing the international conferences and things like that for more than a year. And that's positive. I'm glad that we're finding out ways of being active and creative, even though we have been hampered by this pandemic and the pandemic response.
I couldn't agree more. And we've got to, I use a Bowden expression, to step over it, that accusation. Oh, you're a bit of a fascist, aren't you? And he says that famous line, I'm stepping over that. We need to do that in relation to Charlottesville and events of that nature as well. We are bigger than that. We're going to step beyond that. We're going to come back. We're going to use our intelligence. We're going to use our, our thinking processes. And we're going to use not just all forms of media, but meeting in real life as well, to advance a cause that essentially we're all committed to and has to win. There's no question.
Yeah. Yeah. So one thing I asked you in the print interview that we did was about the fact that you depict your characters as very much part of an intellectual underground milieu. Yeah. You do that very much in the novel that Countercurrents published, which I thought was really interesting, this whole mostly Eastern European revolutionary demimonde. And you do this as well in Resistance. They're constantly reading and talking about novels and philosophers and things like that. And I thought that was admirable to model that kind of behavior. But I've gotten a little disturbed by how few people in our sphere read books as opposed to spend their time on social media and things like that. So, instead of playing games, instead of spending a lot of time on social media, you depict a revolutionary movement where people are doing activism and training and things like that, but also intensely reading literature in multiple languages. I think that's an interesting feature of your work. Do you want to comment a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, it also could be a weakness. You're right. One has to be realistic. I think that's where a little bit of my sort of literary pretension and interests come to the fore and maybe overcome the sort of the artistic sort of realism of the novels. However, I'm trying, as I said earlier, to just embed within the text references to thinkers and writers and books. And I think you're right. I think, you know, most of the people that we're dealing with, particularly of the younger generation, have so many other forms of distraction. They're not necessarily bad. If social media was a positive asset, I'm using a big question mark after that, it could be a very positive thing. But we know that's not the case in many circumstances, particularly those who run it at the moment, with your algorithms and everything else. So I probably do lean a bit too heavily on that. My only defense in that circumstance is to say basically that it is to draw people in to pick up and think, oh, I wonder what that book's about. I wonder who that guy is. I'm going to look on the internet and search up that guy or that lady or that woman who said that thing. And certainly several readers have come back to me and actually, you know, said that's what they've done. They've literally, you know, searched out almost, if I use the word study, that's too much, but have certainly researched people that they never heard about and actually found a bit more out and found it quite interesting. I'll probably try to ease back on some of that in future novels. I think sometimes I'm over the top on that regard, but I love the idea of a not just a literary, but a cultural demimonde, as you describe it, an underground movement that is very, very, you know, united and very, very able to sort of dexterously talk around arguments about philosophy and have different views. Because we're starved of that in the school system, Greg. We're starved of that.
Yeah. And I don't think you should cut back on that at all. I think it is somewhat unrealistic, but I do think that it's a direction that we would like to see people move in. And so I think you can improve the world by giving people intriguing models of alternative forms of behavior. And ultimately we want people to behave differently. We want people to be more idealistic, more committed, more cultured and more educated. And they're not getting that from the mainstream. So yes, I think we should be encouraging it in every way possible in our own sphere. So I think that what you're doing there is actually good, precisely because it isn't realistic. It's not realistic yet.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think the realistic yet, I'm glad you added that caveat because I recognize that. I think that's where we need to get to. And we are well off that. You know, the fuss in the UK, we saw that fuss in the in Loudoun County. It was in Loudoun County, yeah, with the politically correct and the white privilege type of arguments. And there was a real fuss at the school board in the US. It was in Virginia, if I remember rightly. Mm-hmm. But that's right across the board. It's not just limited to the US, obviously. In the British university systems right at this moment, it is even worse. I can assure you, having worked, you know, deeply embedded in that part of the economy, it is incredible. It's incredible. It's no longer education, higher education. It is literally propaganda and training. We have a major obstacle to overcome in higher education right across the West, but certainly in my experience in the UK. And I worked with Georgetown University. I worked with Wisconsin-Madison. And Texas A&M in different ways, across different academic disciplines. But still, you know, incredible political correctness, incredible wokeism embedded, almost embedded and trained into young academics and researchers from the minute they sign the form to join the organization. That's only going to escalate with the generations.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And I think that we need to be thinking in terms of creating alternative institutions to keep the life of the mind alive and to keep the Western tradition alive. This is why I think Alistair MacIntyre's book, After Virtue, has such a powerful end, because he says there that we are entering a dark age, basically. And the barbarians aren't outside the gates. They're ruling over us. And therefore, we need to create alternative institutions to keep alive what he's talking about in the book, specifically the tradition of the virtues, but more broadly, just the whole Western tradition. We are the people who care about it. We're the people who are its legitimate heirs. And we're the only people who can preserve it and carry it forward. And we need to create those alternative institutions, because the leading institutions of our society are destroying. They're not just failing to educate people. They're actually destroying the things that they should be preserving. They're destroying people's minds, and they're destroying the tradition that they should be educating people into. So we've got to do something alternative, and in any way possible, even if it's just to encourage people to take up self-education.
I would agree. Blair made that statement, education, in the UK many years ago. And really what he was saying was propaganda. They expanded the sort of entry into universities dramatically, and it risked standards. Now, the reality is that lots of people are getting into university at the moment. I'll just use one example. Stormzy, an international rap star name, has just crowbarred in another 30 non-whites into Cambridge with his sort of stipends. Quite incredible. And it's a real risk to standards. It's a real risk to our future, because we need these young people to be extremely active, obviously, and to be original thinkers and critical thinkers. And we're not training people to be critical thinkers in any field anymore. Engineering now, you can't even talk about, Newton and the laws of physics. You can't talk about a whole range of, serious in, national figures or international figures that gave us, whole theories about gravity, for example, because they're linked apparently to the slave trade, or they may have benefited from that. So, we really need to get beyond all this, and we need to take the enemy on, basically, with this. And the only way to do it is, I agree with you, we need to set up our own institutions or self-educate. I know, Patriot Alternative have got their own education program started up. I've looked at some of the content of that. It looks blooming interesting, quite frankly, and quite detailed. They've had professionals work on that. It's not sort of an ad hoc thing. They've had, teachers with substantial experience work on an alternative curriculum. And I think that's a really admirable development. I don't know if there are similar types of setups and projects in the US, but certainly that one seems to be taking off relatively well in the UK, and all power to them. I think it's a great initiative.
So tell us more about the things that are going on in the UK that you get behind. What is happening in the UK scene? I haven't been there in a while. I don't even know if I could set foot there, frankly, again. And I very much enjoyed and valued the London Forum when it was still an active force. And now it's basically done. At least it's on a long hiatus. Patriotic Alternative is there. Are there any other things going on in the UK community?
Well, you know, the UK is far, far behind the rest of Europe in terms of what I've described as even civic nationalism. You know, the Brexit Party and UKIP, I mean, you know, there's been articles on your website. You've made comment about these organizations yourself. They are faux organizations. They are one-trick ponies. They're not nationalist in the real sense. They're certainly not ethnic nationalist in any sense whatsoever. So really, the UK-based traditional nationalism that I would identify with has been moribund for some time. Now, you mentioned the London Forum. I remember watching the videos on YouTube, etc., of the London Forum with great speakers, you know, Richard Edmonds, for example, Kai Muros, a whole range of speakers that were, you know, quite marvelous, really, in terms of the range of not only the, you know, their backgrounds, but the themes they spoke on. And I think it was a really well-organized thing. Jez Turner did a really good job there, and he ought to be thanked. He did go to prison for a short time, I understand, for some of the things he said. But that is an indication of the incredible threat now posed on in Britain. We don't have a First Amendment, like the US, obviously. So, you know, we are really living on the cusp in the UK of Orwell's 84. I'm not exaggerating. 1984 we're really living on the cusp of that now. We have, you know, migrants coming across the channel, giving the Churchill V sign, being put in three-star accommodation with balconies overlooking the sea. We have non-white criminals involved in BLM who are on video drop-kicking policemen on the street in Westminster, being set free by our courts. This is the reality of the UK at the moment. We have jihadis who have been released after a short prison sentence, stabbing people in Streatham, within 3 days of being released. This is what Johnson, Patel, Sunak, and Javid, and Rab are doing in the UK. And I know that's replicated. I am only too aware of the United States. And I'm only too aware of the almost embarrassing presidential election and the outcome, and the even more embarrassing president that you guys have to labor under now. And that clown of a vice president. I studied American studies and, you know, American politics in depth. You know, all the famous writers, Clinton, Rossiter, you know, and de Tocqueville, you know, I read all those, so I'm very familiar with your systems. And to see the denigration of a great constitution and a great, you know, a great democratic system be destroyed and represented by people of that ilk is just sad. It's beyond sad. It breaks my heart. But it is, your American listeners really need to know this, it is no better here. Johnson is completely a globalist puppet, and everything he is doing is suiting the globalist trends that we face across the board. So unlike Salvini in Italy and Meloni, who works with him, unlike... And I will give some, Greg, if you'll excuse, I know I'm going on a bit, but I will give some latitude to Marine Le Pen. I think she has cucked a little too far, to say the least, but I still want her, obviously, to win. You know, I think she's up against it, because they'll create another synthetic character like Macron. Macron's too unpopular to win, but I think they'll bring someone else in to try to steal the election there. And they would do exactly the same in the UK. So at the moment, we're a one-trick pony in the UK. We have one really lead organisation, and that is PA. They're still in the formative stage. They're doing lots of good stuff. I suggest your readers and your listeners check out the recent event on Ben Nevis, where in Scotland, a very tall mountain in Scotland, White Lives Matter banner was rolled out across a beautiful blue Scottish skyline with quite a lot of PA supporters there. And we've got Indigenous Peoples Day in a few days' time. And Laura and Mark have got big plans for that as well. And they may even be more grandiose than that, you know, White Lives Matter projection onto Dover. So fingers crossed. I've got a lot of confidence in the movement. It's moving forward. I make lots of contributions to it in terms of the website. I'm very supportive. And I think also some characters, and I'll I'll name drop you, but people you have known and visited in North Wales, for example, I'm in contact with them, and they have definitely lifted my spirits in relation to their thinking processes. Of course, they've got incredible experience as well. Okay, so they've been in the movement because probably since the early 70s. So they are senior figures who are still influential, and people like myself need to look to for advice and guidance.
Yeah, that's very encouraging, actually. I do agree with you that France might be the country that goes first in the West.
Yeah.
And I think that for a number of reasons. One, the Front National, or the National Rally now, is a big thing. They're an actual political threat, unlike any other parties in the West. And beyond that, there's a huge rightist culture that they are rooted in. It even contains people who would never vote for them or don't like them. But the point is that there's a real culture there. It's not marginal. It's enormous. Beyond that, France has a glorious tradition of overturning its republics.
Yeah.
Because the French, for some reason, just don't have a genius for republican government that tracks the common good and preserves the common good. And they have a tendency, therefore, to look for alternatives, new constitutions or strong men or maybe strong women coming in and taking over and reorienting things, putting things back on the right track. That is part of the French tradition. I also think that the French military and police services are far less corrupted than the American military, for instance.
Yeah.
So there are deep institutional reactionary patriotic forces in France that I think that they can draw upon, whereas in the Anglosphere, it's much weaker. It's much smaller, these forces, and they're much more marginalized, and they're really outside the political system for the most part.
They are. And I'm glad you mentioned the French military, because, of course, there was the famous event a few weeks ago, months ago now, where quite a large number of them signed a very vituperative letter saying that the civil war could erupt in France within a short period of time. And I read that with a smile on my face, not because I welcome that situation, far from it, the exact reverse. But the reality is they are right. They are absolutely right. And those people are the children or the grandchildren, or certainly people who have been influenced by, Algérie Française and the whole disaster around how France handled that withdrawal, if you like, from North Africa. Because what's actually happened is North Africa came to France, okay, in large numbers, and they keep coming. It's totally disproportionate. And the sense of what is French, Macron goes, French has many cultures. Well, of course, French has many cultures. It's from Picardy, it's from Brittany, it's from the Loire, the Midi. That's French culture. And having lived there for some time and muddled my way through France, I absolutely agree with you. They're a distinct people, as all people are, distinct European group. They have real respect for theoreticians and thinkers, often of the left, I admit, mostly of the left, actually. But nevertheless, they have respect and time for that. There's still that culture. And you're right, there's still that strand of OAS mentality, which is embedded generationally in their thinking. And I'm always encouraged by that. So like you, I think France will be a linchpin. France will go first, but it's our biggest opportunity to turn the tide.
Because absolutely. We need a major country, and France is a major country. A country with an independent nuclear deterrent,
yes,
that decides to go nationalist and rectify its demographic problems could not be simply knocked off like Serbia was by NATO bombers. That has to be avoided, and therefore there are very few countries that fit that description. the UK is basically too linked to the American system to expect any kind of independent activity at all. And that really leaves France. Germany, I think, it's a crucial great nation in Europe, but they don't have an independent nuclear deterrent. And they're the most brainwashed nation in Europe. And I think that, you know, there's very little hope there. But if the French go nationalist, I think you would find that, first of all, the United States would huff and puff and rant and rave, but basically be in a position to do nothing about it. And then you would quietly see a reorientation of other countries in Europe. They would quietly think, we can solve our problems now. We can deal with this. And you would find that openly or, you know, quietly, they'd start backing away from the abyss. I think that would be very, very valuable. So the French really are the key. And I do think that the forces in France are there. And I think the Yellow Vest uprising was an extremely interesting phenomenon because nobody predicted it. It was a viral phenomenon, a viral populist phenomenon. It propagated through the internet, but it also propagated through existing IRL networks because there's very dense networks of people in France, real world networks. And that's an enormous help because the system, you know, if France goes into a 1968 again, but in reverse kind of situation, the first thing they'll do is try and shut down digital communication, you know, the telephones, the internet, etc. But if you have a much more robust revolutionary populace with real world relationships, you can't throw the switch on the real world. You can't shut down the real world. You can't shut down people's face-to-face relationships with their neighbors and things like that.
And France is blessed because, and I'll use these terms quite broadly, despite the fact that obviously there's been vast amounts, particularly of young people moving into the cities from the rural areas for work and for jobs and for all sorts of things of that nature. The reality is it's still grounded in a predominantly Catholic culture. Now, I'm not particularly religious myself, but when I use the word Catholic, I mean it's around that family. It's beyond the religious element. There's a strong sort of identity within the family grouping, within the community grouping, which the globalists haven't quite managed to eradicate from France yet. It's well on the way to attempting it and trying its best, but it hasn't succeeded in doing that to the same extent it's done in the UK. The UK has been decimated in that regard. And I think countries like Italy, for example, and countries like France and Spain offer some opportunities to they're very old traditional cultural situations which can be used. And I don't mean cynically used, I mean used to our benefit. And I think it's really important that we do that, because otherwise, you know, we come from a traditionalist background. It's a revolutionary element to it as well, but we come from the traditions. We're maintaining the traditions and advancing and breathing fresh life into existing traditions as they naturally develop over time, originating from a community that is identifiably ethnic and by language, by genetics, by culture. So I think you're absolutely right. And I think, although I was very pro-Brexit for all sorts of reasons, The one element that always made me wonder, Greg, and worry was I could see if we can dismantle, this is me being very, very optimistic here, if you can dismantle the EU presidium, if you like, in Brussels and Strasbourg, and you add a forum of national governments, I don't mean nationalist, but national governments, hopefully nationalist governments, right, working together, that would be a wonderful transformation of, I'll use the word EU for convenience, but a wonderful transformation. Because I utterly believe in a Europe of 100 flags. I think we can work together. We can put aside the sort of 100 years war. The French can forgive us for Agincourt. We'll forgive them hopefully they'll forgive us for leaving them all behind during the Second World War. So we can actually work together, because the threat now is not between European countries. It's not between the economics of European countries and our wealth generation. You know exactly, better than I do, where the threat comes from. It's a vast threat, and we all face that in our own countries. You face it on the southern border with flights going out of US air bases, transporting, young non-white males all around your country, okay? It's exactly the same in the UK. We're dispersing people that have no claim to being here all around our country. And it's happening all across Europe. And that is well understood. Your website identifies that and talks about that as a major problem. All the right-wing people talk about that. That's not a debate. That's not a conspiracy. That's a fact. And that's where we need to draw the line. You know, we need to control ourselves, we need to rule ourselves, and we need to make decisions in our own interest. That doesn't mean we have to hurt anybody. That doesn't mean we have to be haters. We're not. It means that we actually look after ourselves and ensure that we're in the best state we can be before we go out into the world, not as colonialists, but as not necessarily benefactors, but as people who can add value to the globe, not as people that are going to be overrun by, if you like, you used the term earlier, and I agree with you, the barbarians.
Yeah. Every time somebody in the United States buys a gun, I know it's illegal there now for the Brits, but when people go to gun shows and buy a gun, a lot of them think to themselves, I hope to God I never have to use this. But they buy them anyway, and there are hundreds of millions of weapons in the United States. A lot of people hope to God it never comes to that. And I read a lot of this revolutionary fiction, including your work, including the work of somebody like Harold Covington. And I think this should not be regarded as a blueprint so much as a warning. Mm-hmm. And I hope to God it never comes to this. I hope that people wake up, that they listen to reason, and that they back away from the catastrophe that awaits, because we know that diversity isn't a source of strength. It isn't a source of harmony. It's a source of conflict. And mainlining this, going all out, pushing diversity, even while people are being told that they can't go out and visit their family at holidays, the borders are still open, and the refugees, the migrants, the replacements are still flooding in. It's only going to end in bloodshed unless people listen to reason.
Absolutely. And you're right. You use the expression blueprint, and I think that's absolutely the right word to use. These fictional novels, my own included, they are not a blueprint. They are, it's literally a green, amber, red light scenario. I'm flashing up at the amber light very brightly, and it's flickering, and it's been flickering for a long time now, to say, this is an these fictions will become reality, an inevitable reality, unless common sense is applied now. And a lot of people come back to me and say, it's already too late. You know, we're going to be into the scenarios that you anticipate in your fiction. And like you, that's the last thing we need. It isn't going to help anybody. We need to stop it well before that point. However, I'm afraid our opponents are not going to listen. Rational arguments just do not apply. We had the RNLI, our Coast Guards, and everyone else literally ferrying people across the channel for months now. And they keep mentioning in the press, there was a woman and a baby. Yeah, look at the photographs. Of the 39 people that came, there was one woman, one baby, and 28 22-year-olds clutching their mobile phones and, you know, just delighted to arrive in the UK and holding out their hands, just waiting for the paycheck. This is in fiction, and that is not scaremongering, what I've just said. That's provable fact. And our governments are facilitating that. They are facilitating it. And that means the government is no longer acting in the interest of the people that elected it. Or rather, and in the US, you'll understand this better than I, they're acting in the interest of people who in the future will elect them.
Yeah, they are electing a new people. They're choosing a new people, which, of course, is a complete inversion of what democracy should be. Democracy is the idea that the people choose the elites and subordinate the elites to their interests. The system that we have today, the elites are basically absolutely determined to maintain their power. And to do that, they are choosing a new people that they think will be more reliable clients to keep them in power. That's a complete inversion of the democratic principle. It's a complete inversion of democratic legitimacy. It is not legitimate by democratic standards.
No, it's not. It's just totally illegitimate. And I don't want to harp on about it, but that's why when I looked on the, you know, I looked on in utter shock, really, at the flagrant electoral gerrymandering in the US, and was just stunned. Now, like yourself and other people, I wouldn't describe Trump in any way, shape or form as our man at all in many ways. But I do feel, looking as an observer, an external observer looking in, there were plenty of scenarios going on there that were extremely worrisome for the American electoral system, regardless of whether ultimately that changed the result. But look at the result. You have a stammering clown as a vice president, who I don't believe can be elected as president. I think if anyone runs against her, if she secures the Democratic nomination in the future, that'll be a shock to me. But I've been proven wrong before. And you've got a one-term existing president who is making a fool of himself and the American people, God bless them, across the globe. Only matched, of course, because I can claim no greater situation, by Boris Johnson. You know, I mean, another clown and a buffoon. So if this is the best states people we've got, statesmen in this case we've got, we really do need a revolution.
Yeah, and I think something dramatic is going to happen simply because you can't keep an unsustainable system sustained forever. And they're making all kinds of mistakes. The underlying fundamentals of their political philosophy are wrong to begin with. And then pile on all these crises, COVID, Black Lives Matter, economic consequences of both COVID and Black Lives Matter, the legitimacy crisis of a stolen election. They're really flirting with disaster. I think it's a very fragile system.
Yeah, and the lockdown of the White House immediately after November the 6th. I mean, if people don't get the signal there, then you'll never, you know, I suggest you do read 1984, because I've always been a believer, not so much that we will end up in 1984 as quickly as we have, but that we would go, and I think we have gone for some time through the, you know, Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, the world of the Soma, you know, and the sort of mild oppression and the mild control that sort of numbs us, if you like. And I think that's been going on for decades. But now the hard edge is becoming incredibly obvious to me. And I know other people have said this before, so I'm not being particularly original, but I can see these things come to the fore. And I think, you know, the crises, the whole COVID scenario. I've not had jabs for all sorts of reasons, but certainly I wouldn't have the jabs. I'm deeply suspicious about the motivations, especially with the likes of Bill Gates involved and people like that. You know, the land grab of Gates, and I think the Chinese as well in the Midwest at the moment is unbelievable. Let's look at the signs. You know, let's read where the money goes. I think Richard Edmonds said once, and he tapped his nose very wisely. This was probably a meeting you might have been at, Greg, in the London Forum, when he made a speech, and he said, you know, just follow the money, and who's going to benefit? And I think Richard, bless him, long gone now. Well, not that long gone, but a wise old soul, a sentinel, as I always describe him, someone who had some instincts, and I tend to agree with him on that one. I think follow the money, and we'll see what emerges. Very, very, you know, in 5 years' time, when we're looking back at this crisis, we will see what the likes of Fauci and others have been responsible for.
Well, we have been going at this for an hour. Time really does fly by. I would like to wrap up, and I would like to know what's next for you. What are you working on now?
Well, right at this moment, as I mentioned at the start, I'm literally pumping out articles for PA because you know they deserve as much of my time as I can give them. There's some great writers on PA. You know, you've got Jim Goad, you've got Robert Ampton, you've got a whole plethora of big names who write some Richard Hook, who write great material for you. PA is developing some really good writers as well. Ben Arison, there's several others who I really admire. So I'm contributing heavily there on a daily, or certainly a couple of times a week articles. But in terms of my own artistic ambitions, I'm now working on a novel that's going to be a prequel to The Partisan, or rather, not a prequel exactly, but a linked much more closely to The Partisan. So you'll see the reemergence of Sabine Dorlach prior to the end of The Partisan. It's a backfiller story, which fills in some of the gaps in my first novel. So that one is about three quarters written. I'm also working on a novel called, at the moment, the working title is Untergrund, Underground in German. So that'll be based in Germany. And I'm working on one that's also partially written, based in the UK. So that'll be another three novels that hopefully will take the project forward, as I described earlier. They're all interlinked, but you can read them all individually and singularly, obviously. Hopefully people can enjoy them in that way. But the idea is that people read them, obviously, and get a taste for them, and not only buy books like your own, for example, on your website, The White Nationalist Manifesto, etc., but actually, the other books in the series as well. I always say it, and I'll end with this, Greg, it's really important that people understand that the time I give and what little contribution I can make in terms of writing is always given freely. The profits of the books always go back to the publishers or to the websites and the demonetized organizations that I support. So it's if you like, my contribution in kind as best I can manage. And it's small amounts, obviously. I'm not writing Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code, but every penny counts. Every dollar counts. And I really encourage everyone who's listening to this podcast, who reads Countercurrents, to contribute, not just financially, but in terms of written content, and do the best they can. This movement needs to flourish. Countercurrents is a shining example of the talents we have available to us. And the work that you do has been an inspiration to me. So really, I look to people like yourself to keep going and keep fighting the good fight. And I will do the best to support you, and I will do the best to support PA in the UK well into the future. We have no option, and I enjoy it.
Well, that is very, very kind. And I think that is a wonderful way of wrapping up. It's a very hopeful note. And I look forward to having another conversation. It's been too long coming, and I would very much like to continue this discussion in the future. So, Fennec Solaire, thank you so much, and we will be back again for another episode of Countercurrents Radio.